Thank you so much, Melissa. Hi, everybody. I'm Debbie Davis, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Debbie.
And it has, just been fantastic being here. I want to thank Ellen and Dick for asking me and inviting my husband to come with, because he's been just as excited. He's been telling everybody he sponsors and stuff, I get to spend a whole week with my sponsor. And they didn't know I was also going to be here, you know? And so just, you know, wanted to get that in that I was here too. But it's been great for him, and I have just gotten to meet up with so many people that I've known for a lot of years from a lot of places. And gosh, I won't start naming names because that's all my talk will be, but thank you for the invitation. And I've never been to Crested Butte, and it is just probably one of the prettiest places I remember being. It is, I can see why so many come back year after year. It is just a magical kind of a place. And this conference committee is really amazing. I mean, I've had so many different hosts, and the paperwork has been quite phenomenal. Most places I get invited to, everything fits in an envelope. About 3 months ago, I graduated to a full-size folder with all the correspondence, notes, cards, calls, everything in there. And so you knew where you were going to be this week, and was in Colorado with y'all. And so anyway, thank you so much. I want to welcome the people who are new, and I want to thank the people who are ahead of me, because I like being right in the middle. And it's easy for me to remember when Tom got sober, because he got sober the same year I was born. So I was always remember how old Tom is. And I welcome the gal who's here with 2 days, because I know how that is, what that's like too. And for the new people that are here, if you're restless, irritable, and discontent and sitting in these chairs and wondering what's going on and wonder if you're an alcoholic or you're getting bored here or resentful or restless, let me tell you what's worked for me to change all those things around and why I've been able to stay here for a period of time. There are 3 important things in my life I always like to tell you first, because without these 3 things in my life in an active state, I don't stay comfortable, and after a period of time, I won't be sober. And I want to stay sober one day at a time for the rest of my life. And there are certain things that I need to keep active. I am always reminded that I have a daily reprieve. And there's been times in my life when I've been more reminded than others. But that has always been a constant. But those 3 things are a sobriety date, a home group, and a sponsor. We have the triangle of recovery, unity, and service. And I work very hard to keep that active and applied in my life. There's this other triangle, that's my personal triangle. And my sobriety date is February the 8th, 1976, which means I've been sober over 29 years. That's not my first sobriety date. And it's not my first one, but it's my last one. And it will stay my last one as long as I continue to do the daily maintenance. So what's some of the daily maintenance that I do? Just a few of those things are every day. I start my day off with prayer. I choose to do it on my knees because I need to be visually reminded of who's in charge and that it's not me. And it's an act of being humble for me to start off the day that way, and I like that. And I have my time with God. I close my day in the same way, and I say thanks. I start my day with asking him to please help me stay sober today, relieve me of any obsessions that may come into my life, and to show me how you want me to be of service. And I say the 3rd-step prayer, the 7th-step prayer. We may chat a little bit more, and then I get on about my business. And some of the ways that I of service then is, one of the big things is I don't take that first drink or anything else that affects me from the neck up. And I take my physical sobriety very, very seriously. That means I don't futz and fool around with it. I don't drink near beer. Okay? I don't smoke near pot. I don't take health store speed. I don't care what kind of a realistic name it's called or cute, because I am an alcoholic described in the doctor's opinion that I drink essentially because I like the effect produced by alcohol, and I got the effect the first night I drank, and I loved the new world I went into. And I'm the kind of person that I never did anything half measures in drinking, and I don't want to half measures my life here in sobriety either. And so I don't fool around and play around with that. I also answer my phone without screening my calls, because most of my opportunities for service come through the telephone. And if I really meant what I said this morning, or any morning, show me how you want me to be of service, I can't pick and choose by who's on the phone. And so that's been a very big thing. I'll tell you, that could be a spiritual experience sometimes too, you know, when you pick up that phone. I still go on 12-step calls. I still am on the hotline answering, turn them over calls. I still need to have a commitment in my home group, which I'll talk about next. But these are some of the main daily things that I do. My physical sobriety needs to be in place 24/7 in order for anything else in this program, in order to work in my life. It's got to have something to stick to. But I also know that that's just the launching pad. That's our base common denominator. But I tried the just not drinking part of the program, and I didn't stay sober. Because I had the impression from non-alcoholics when they would ask me questions like, why do you always have to get drunk? Or why can't you have a couple like we do? Those are really, really good questions, really legitimate questions. But my answer was absolutely the honest truth, and I didn't know it. I just said, I don't know. I didn't know. What I did know is that I always liked to get drunk. I always liked to just let her rip. I never thought about having a couple. I never thought about not getting drunk. That never occurred to me. From the very first night I drank, that was the plan. So I didn't know anything, but what I would come to realize is that I have a disease called alcoholism, and I am powerless. I am powerless when it comes to alcohol, on my own. And so I tried the not drinking part, and I drank again. And then I did the not drinking and going to some meetings part, those couple of things in there, and I drank again. And until I took those steps, and what was read tonight was just perfect. I love those paragraphs too. I have had a revolutionary change in my feeling and attitude because I've taken these steps in my life and I've developed a relationship with the God of my own understanding. I've taken the actions as they've been laid out and my life has changed. Now that doesn't mean I get to go like that. I have a responsibility to pass this on in order to keep it. I have a responsibility to maintain my spiritual connection on a daily current basis. So that is where it begins, is in that sobriety date. And if you are new here and you don't have one yet, I really encourage you to get one, because Alcoholics Anonymous made a lot more sense to me when I was sober. So just a suggestion, you know. But that home group is so vital in my life. What I realized, I've lived in various parts of the country. I realized on this last move, I've lived in 4 very different areas of the country. And I've really liked having those different experiences. I've also had, because of that, 4 different home groups. So far, that is the only reason I've ever left a home group. It hasn't been because of a personality. It hasn't been because I didn't like those people. I left the state. That's why I changed home groups. And what I realized is that I've also had 4 different last names. Okay, it just kind of worked out that way. I got sober in Minneapolis. That's not where I'm from. I started in South Dakota and North Dakota, and I ended up in a halfway house in Minneapolis, and that's where I finally got sober. I was a member of the 12 and 12 group there in Minneapolis, and my last name was my original maiden name, which was Fegan. And I was there about 4 years when I moved to Atlanta. I lived there for almost 7 years, was a member of the Skyland group, and my last name, due to a profession I was interested in getting into, I legally changed my name to Richards. And then I moved to Southern California, moved to Long Beach, was a member of the Bellflower Big Book group. I moved there because I had gotten married, and my last name there was Harris. And then I moved to Northern California due to marriage, and Davis is now my last name, and my home group's the Primary Purpose Group, meets Thursday nights, 8 o'clock in Dublin, and y'all are welcome. It's an open meeting. And a home group has taught me so much on how to live out there, not just in here, but out there. You've taught me in the beginning some very, very important things. You taught me again about courtesy and consideration in a home group. I did not know how to do that. The mirror was always in front of my face, what was interesting to me, what I wanted to do, who I wanted to listen to. And you taught me about that courtesy to other people, that perhaps they would like to listen and not have me fussing around or trying to talk to them about a date I had last night, about getting there early and about staying late, about being a part of the meeting, about having a commitment, learning how to give anonymously, that I don't need to have a big deal job in order for it to be, you know, worthy of my time, but to be anonymous. I've served my groups in all kinds of ways, from being the secretary or a GSR representative of some type, to the in charge of the women's toilet paper. And I'll tell you what, if that's empty, you are found, I'm telling you. They're looking for you. And they're all important. Every job I've had has been important for the next level for me to grow, to change, to get to know people, a new experience. And I so believe in rotation in a home group, because I know I would have kept some of those jobs ad infinitum, but I would have also denied somebody else the joy of that job. I believe in a home group because you taught me here how to be a better daughter. I'm an only child, and I took that first drink, and I just, not consciously or made any big decision, it just all, the curtain came down emotionally, mentally, and of any kind of need for them. And I lived in that house, but I was no longer a participant. I just shut down. And I would get sober, I would make my amends, and for the next 14 years, I'd call them a couple times a year. We all lived in different states, and I liked it like that. Because it was like, now I don't have the guilt of when are you coming home for dinner, for supper, or I mean, for the holidays and stuff like that. And I mean, they weren't calling me either, but I was calling to make sure we all had the same phone number, same address, still alive, that kind of stuff. And about 14 years sober, I got to thinking, you know, I think it's important that I develop a relationship with this family. I am their only child. And so I listened to how you repaired the relationship in your family with your parents or children, whichever your case was. And because you taught me to do what you say you're gonna do, I figured out what I could do. And I called him the first Sunday in January of 1991, and I said, I'm gonna call you the first Sunday of every month. And I haven't missed that commitment in over 14 and a half years, whatever it is. And that's not saying I'm wonderful, it's saying you have changed me. You taught me how to take a commitment and take it responsibly and fulfill it. And it doesn't mean, again, that I'm wonderful. It means I have a sticky note that goes from month to month as soon as all the calls are made, so that I don't forget that first Sunday of the month when I'm whipping around my day. You have developed that, and I just spent quite a bit of time for me with both of each of these parents, and it was a really, really nice experience. And if nothing ever happened from here on out, I have some really nice memories of those times with them and they with me. You have given them back a daughter they can be proud of. You taught me how to be a better employee, that because you said, you know, if you're supposed to show up there at 8 o'clock and work till 5, you do that every day, you're supposed to do that. And my attitude was, but it's not convenient. I don't feel well. You know, we're hungover. And I just am always looking to get there late and leave there early, and you taught me how to be a better employee. You taught me how to take tradition one into the workplace, that the unity of that company comes first, and my little whims and whines come second. And so you taught me how to be a better employee. You taught me, whoa, did you teach me how to place principles before personalities. You know, that's one of the reasons I answer my phone without screening my calls. It's one of the reasons that it's very important in my regular meetings that I am working the room. I am looking for those unfamiliar faces to make sure they've had at least one warm welcome in that meeting. That's why I like getting there early and staying late. I like those bookend meetings that go on. That's the given part, and then during that meeting I get to do the input. and then give it back away. I love work in the room, and it gives me that opportunity to do that. And I've been in the meetings where, you know, every home group I've had, there's always been a couple of people that I just know would be so much happier in another home group, you know? I know these things. I just, you know. And isn't it amazing that I'm the one that moved? You know, I'm the one that's been in different states. And I've just learned that history in a meeting is so valuable to me. The personalities will come and they will go. And I'm sure that there's always people wishing I'd go somewhere else for the meeting, you know? So I can't think I'm everybody's darling either. And so you've taught me how to place those principles before personalities. I know what it's like sitting in a meeting where it's me and the soon-to-be ex-he and the brand-new she, okay? Those are awkward. And I used to have a little gauge that if I knew where either of them were, I wasn't doing my job. Because I've only got one job in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's to work the room and carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. That might be a male friend I might know, but mostly I'm looking for the women. I'm looking for the women. And that was my gauge, whether I was doing my job or not. And so anyway, a home group has proven so valuable to me. And that third thing is a sponsor. We've heard a lot about sponsorship so far, and I'm right there with you. I've had three sponsors in sobriety, again, because I have lived in different parts of the country. I had one in Minneapolis, one in Atlanta, and one in Southern California. Millie G is my current sponsor. We've been walking this path 18 and a half years together. And I don't take that sponsorship as, you know, it's going to go on for the ends of the earth. She's not a spring chicken, but I, in my own mind, I have my own backup. Because I don't ever want to fool myself that because I might have some length of sobriety that I can go without sponsorship. I don't want to go without sponsorship. That person in my life has been so valuable because she doesn't need to tell me, you know, what color to paint my nails, or, and it's not about running my life in a militant way. But what it is that sometimes I get tripped up with my own emotions and the right thing to do. And what is kind and loving and what is self-will. And I can get tripped up on those kinds of things. I need somebody that I know. I've never, ever been patronized, yelled at, hung up by a sponsor. I don't treat them that way. They've always been treated with respect. I treat the people I sponsor that way as well. Because this is about helping each other. And they've been the people I've asked to sponsor me have been the people that I want to be like when I grow up. That's been the gauge for me. None of my sponsors have had even remotely the same drinking story I've had, except the fact that we both have the disease of alcoholism. But they live this way of life in all areas of their life in such a beautiful way that I don't know what you do, but I'm going to follow and see what you do. I'm going to do what you do because I want what you have. And a sponsor's been so, so very valuable to me. And so these three things, if you don't have these in an active state and you don't like the way you're living, I invite you to incorporate them in your life because they have made the difference in drinking and having a joyful sobriety for me. And that is a sobriety date that's honest, a home group that I'm an active member in, and a sponsor that I actively work with. They've been the magical key for me on this journey. But my journey to Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't anything on my path. It was something I didn't even know existed. Even when I was heavy into my drinking, I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I took my first drink on a Friday the 13th. I have loved Fridays ever since. I took my first drink the same year Cliff got sober, 1970. I was 12 years old when I took my first drink. And here we are in the same place. Yeah, I like that. And it was a Friday night. I'd been invited earlier in the week by the cool kids in school for this upcoming party. And I so wanted to hang out with them. I didn't belong with the smart kids, and I didn't belong with the athletic kids. But these kids were smoking cigarettes, drinking beer, skipping school, and they looked like they were having some fun. And they had invited me for this Friday night. Boy, wild horses weren't going to keep me away from that party. And that Friday morning came, and I woke up with my same thoughts in the morning. I be a good daughter, a good student, obey the rules, stay out of trouble. I've never liked negative attention. I'm not a rebel. I'm not an intentional troublemaker. I want to do the right thing. I always have. And in sobriety, I want to do the right thing. And I've got all these good ideals on the front page. And then on that second thought is, I'm going to get drunk tonight. Little do I know that those two things are going to come in immediate conflict with each other, you know? I don't know anything about drinking, but somehow, some way along the line, I've made that decision that day. I'm going to get drunk. I don't know how you get there. I figure you probably have to drink a whole bunch. I don't know, but that's where I'm going to get. Because this was my only surety in my mind that I would be accepted by these kids. Now, I, not for a second, kind of thought, well, how do my parents drink? My parents are the people that are kind that we call them social drinkers. I've never been one. I didn't know about their drinking really until I got sober and started to look at it. It never occurred to me to drink the way they did, not at all. So that night, I would drink the way I'm going to drink. And there were 12 and 13 years old. It's kind of like a liquid potluck, you know, whatever you stole from your parents or the drugstore, you bring it and you mix it up and God only knows what it is and what it's going to do. But we don't care. We just are going to drink it. And there's a brown bag going around the room and there's a bottle in there and I don't know what's in there, but I know what's in there, alcohol. And I watch what they do because I want to do the right thing. And so it gets to me, and what I saw them do was take a pull off that bottle and give it to the next guy. So I did that. And I don't know, I'm sure y'all remember that first drink just absolutely ripped out your throat. I mean, just destroyed it. Not a problem, you know. You can get another throat, right? I mean, it's just like, who cares about that? Something's going to happen. That's what I was thinking. And that something did happen, because it just went down there, and it was like hot lava is the only analogy I can think of. It was warm, it was thick, it was quiet, and it just flowed in there and filled in these holes in my gut, and I didn't know I had any. But I did know that my shoulders relaxed. You see, I didn't take that first drink because I was run away from a horrible home life. Felt like I'd been dropped off from another planet, couldn't sit still in my own skin. I wasn't running away from mean, cruel people, abuse, any violence, nothing. These were kind and loving people who, Catholic school and the Catholic Church, and I always had all the needs met, most of the wants, just were raising a daughter as best as they could and doing fine. But they got me. And I took that first drink, and my life, the destiny of my life, just changed. And my shoulders relaxed, and I've got this warm glow about 2 inches behind my belly button, and I'm thinking, you know what, I'm 12 years old, oatmeal has never done this for me, you know. I don't know what's in that bottle, but I just want some more of it. So that more now phrase, I knew right away. And when it came down around the second time, because I want the exact same effect, I took the exact same action. I took a pull off of that bottle, I gave it to the next guy, ripped out my throat again, did that magic the second time. But we hear about an invisible line that gets crossed. And I didn't know that I have just crossed it between drink number one and drink number two. I don't know that I have just had my one and only social drink that I will ever have. Didn't know it'd be important, so. That second drink did for me, that took the anxiety up here of whether or not you're going to accept me, and it made it into arrogance down here. And I sort of internally threw my shoulders back, and I looked around that room of kids, and I thought, hey, aren't they glad I'm here? You know, drink number one, please accept me. Drink number two, who needs you? And this world of who needs you is where I loved. I did not know it, but I just couldn't wait to stay there all the time. And I'm not thinking in those conscious kinds of words, but I know that I can be here alone and I'm great. I don't need you anymore. I can be here by myself and I'm real fine right there. That night, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but I know that when I took a drink, I activated this disease big time. I told you that I had my good intentions on spot number one and getting drunk in spot number two. And Saturday morning, I didn't know that I'd activated the part of the disease called the mental obsession. And Saturday morning, they were in reverse. I woke up thinking about drinking and how am I going to get it and what should I get and who should I buy, get to buy it for me and where should I drink it. And those would be the kind of thoughts for the next 6 years. And those good intentions are in spot number two and eventually be removed, because when it comes down to good intentions and drinking, guess who wins? Drinking every time. And I can't do that. I will try and to get out of trouble by getting and trying to activate those things again, but they have no heart in them anymore. The other thing that I activated was that physical craving. I drank that night as much as I could, as fast as I could, whatever I could, and would whenever I could. Now, it's not for me about the quantity or how long I drank, and I used to really have that as kind of my why my case is different. But in our book, it talks very clearly and gives many examples of the short time and the small quantities. And so they kind of ruined that one for me to use as why my case is different. But that night I did that, and from that time, every time I took a drink, I intentionally took a drunk. I never wanted to have just a couple. That never came out of my mouth. I'm going to have, just had, only had a couple. I never heard of that phrase till I got into AA, because I always went for the drunk, for the full out, and it was as fast as I could get there. And I started getting trouble from the very first weekend. But all I thought was, I'm going to have to learn how to lie better. Stopping drinking or anything never occurred to me. Learn how to lie better. And I was never very good at that. And so that didn't serve me well, but I certainly gave it a try. And at 12, I'm drinking at every opportunity I can create. At 13, the way that I drink is I drink whiskey out of a bottle with a beer chaser. Okay, I'm not into foo-foo and ice and mix and stuff. I still don't like ice in my drinks. And this is where I realized, as I looked back, why I never drank like my parents. There are people who always drank out of a glass, okay? They always did. And I was a bottle baby from the very first night. They would have one. Maybe if it's a big night, two. And I would have maybe one bottle and maybe two, but it was never of a short amount, and it was certainly straight whiskey. They would eat. You know, we don't eat, you know, we don't do that. And I looked at that comparison and I saw why my cases did. I just never drank like them. It never interested me to drink like them, and I never thought to do it. And so my drinking at that time, at 13 years old, I'm introduced to the wonderful world of drugs, which allowed me to stay conscious longer before the inevitable blackout. I'm a blackout drinker, and when I drink whiskey straight up, I black out too quickly, and I don't want to be sleeping or missing out on anything through life, so I find things to help keep me awake. And I found things like speed and acid will do that. And they will help you. You'll get there quicker and in color, I'll tell you. And I still like color, as you can see, so some things don't change. But I love this speeded up effort, and I could go for days at that point, and I never thought anything odd or strange about that whatsoever. Fast forward to 1975, it's 5.5 years into my drinking, and I have now been expelled from my senior year of high school for the third and final time, 6 weeks before I'm supposed to graduate. I could have cared less, but my father was more concerned about my education and my welfare than I was. And he had sought professional advice, and they suggested, while you still have legal custody, you need to commit her. And at 17 and a half years old, I'm committed to a treatment center in North Dakota for alcoholism and drug addiction. My attitude was, you know, I'm not even of legal age to buy it yet. I mean, that should be your minimum age qualifier right there. You know, you got to be legal to buy it. And of course, they never paid any attention to that either. So I'm in this particular situation, and I've never heard of the things I'm hearing about. I'm hearing about the disease of alcoholism and sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous, the program of. And you know, I just was baffled about their insistence of a solution to a non-existent drinking problem. I mean, that's really how I saw it. Why would I seek out a solution to that? And so they would take us to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and of course I would sit in the farthest back possible corner available, and I would tune out till they were done doing what I'm doing, sharing their story. But what happened is every now and then I would tune in to what they were saying. And up here I had to rationalize why my case is different. Because if you identify with anything, you may be one of them. And I just, you know, we've got to find all the differences. And so I would hear you say things like, I lost my family because of drinking. Well, my mind said, you can have mine, you know. I don't need them, you know. They're always talking about my drinking, so I'll turn them over to you. And yet that was up here, down here, 2 inches behind my belly button, was one of those places where I knew I had to leave their home because it was no longer a safe place for them to come home to. They never knew what they were coming home to. I understood in that early days about that Jekyll and Hyde. That was me, but in reverse. You know, Dr. Jekyll is, and the true story is nice, everybody loves him, and he's got this interest or curiosity about that dark side, and he creates a potion that puts him into that dark character. He's called Mr. Hyde. That's me in reverse. In the non-drinking, I am Mr. Hyde. I am so messed up inside and so angry and so confused, and there's this ball of fire, and I take a potion called whiskey, and I become Dr. Jekyll. I'm breathing full breaths again, and I'm laughing, and I'm at peace with the world. And even goofy as I was, I knew I had such a swing in personality. I didn't know why. I just liked this Dr. Jekyll personality of mine, which got there through whiskey better. But that wasn't, you know, they didn't like that part. So anyway, so that's about the family, and I heard them talk about totaling out cars. And I can say I have never totaled out a car officially, okay? And, you know, it's kind of like when we get here, we're always looking for the differences. If it wasn't the same make and model, different, no. But I had a little drunk car that arrived here. Okay, you know, when you buy them, they're square. Okay, they start off square. And then because if you drink like I do, because I was the designated drunken driver of my group, they get rounded out with the drunk bumps and things, you know, misjudgments and... In my area, ditches, and you know, you just kind of coast in and out of those babies, and things are falling off, and in addition, my window had been shot out of there, and my gas cap was a mitten I had stuck in there. I'm like driving this Molotov cocktail around, you know, it's just like, jeez. But you know, when you think gas cap drink, gets what wins, you know, the drink wins, right? So. But I'd never officially totaled out a car. I could rationalize that in my mind. And then they talked about losing jobs, and my rationale was, well, I didn't like that place anyway, you know, or I quit before I had gotten fired, or maybe I had been asked to leave. But I always had a little legitimate job going on, and because I was too stupid to know how to support myself. And I remembered one time only, I tried to be a little drug dealer. It was not successful because I was the only client. And so, end of my career in that. So I just had to have a little legitimate job, and I did. And what happened is that I would quit in blackouts. I guess I'm trying to be responsible, I don't know, but the dilemma is that you go to work the next day and you don't know you've quit. You know, this is a problem. and they're surprised, and they explain what's happened, and, you know, then you're surprised, you know, as to, and so it's just so awkward, these kinds of things. And so these are the things that I could rationalize why my case is different. There were two things I heard you say, though, that bothered me. And you talked about all those broken promises. And I wondered how you knew that. Because when I heard that, I had started to take a review of my life, and I had been able to keep a promise since I was 12 years old when I took my first drink. Because there was always the long lecture closed with, and be good. And we all knew that be good meant don't drink or take any drugs, and I would really mean that, because I didn't like being in trouble, but I didn't know that I was powerless over alcohol. I have a disease that is far more greater than me if I don't have any help. And after almost 2 weeks, when that second Friday would roll around, that was as long as I could go on my own. And I just would forget all the promises, I would forget those eyes, I would forget the feelings, and one more time, I'm back on a run. The other thing was, I heard a woman talk about trying to scrub away the smell. And I thought, I've had this funny odor for about a year and I don't know what it is. I've tried to puff and powder and perfume it away, and she says it's booze coming through her pores. And I knew that she knew what that smell smelled like. And she said she was an alcoholic and she didn't drink. And as close as I got was, you know what, if I'm not careful, I might be one of those people. That was as close as I got to that surrender of being an alcoholic. And I knew I wasn't done drinking. After 7 weeks in this treatment center, they sent me to an all-women's halfway house in Minneapolis because I didn't like women, so they thought that'd be a good idea. So now I'm going to go live with 40 of them. And terrified. I've never been in a city that big. And they told me, you know, what to do. Don't drink, don't take any drugs, and go to one Alcoholics Anonymous meeting a month. Okay? I'm not interested in joining or being one of you, so I can do one a month just so I, again, do the right thing and become invisible so nobody really notices me here. But I'm not really going to get involved. I mean, I'm not going to go to two meetings a month. My God, you know, that's pushing it. So I went to that one meeting a month. And you were very nice, and I know you said lots of great things, but I wasn't interested in getting to know you because I knew I wasn't done drinking. I knew that part. And so I went to San Jose to visit my mother for a 2.5-week holiday. The first week I'm miserable because I'm hanging around with the people I used to drink with. The last week and a half I'm drunk and loaded. No surprise. No surprise. Because I had no defense against the first drink. Didn't even ask for one. Was looking to find a way and an opportunity to drink, and I found it very easily. But what happened is I had been exposed to too many AA meetings. I'd been around you just enough to where my drinking was different, and I saw it differently, and I was mad because it had still, in my mind, was the romance and the fantasy of the drinking and the fun that I used to have. And that was gone, so I blamed it on California booze and drugs. It was California that did it. And I came back to Minneapolis and I had an attitude of, well, I've learned my lesson. Stepped my meetings up from one a month to one a week. And that sounded like a lot of meetings to me when you're just doing the not drink and going to meetings type program. And after 5 weeks of that, on a Friday, I get a letter in the mail that had one joint in it. And like any still uncommitted alcoholic, I decided to keep it because I thought, you know, you just never know when you might need something like this. And it's right here. And it was just amazing. I needed it the next day. That timing was so perfect. And of course, you know, I never thought about anything but that stupid little joint. And it was a great lesson for me because we don't keep alcohol or in our home. We don't keep social drugs for any potential visitors that might come in, okay? We just don't do that because there have been many times that I have been very solid here in this program, and whoosh, the thought has gone by that if there was alcohol in there, I would drink it. I do not want to make a drink so easy to me. I need to have a pause factor put right in there. I need effort so that I have an opportunity to change the direction. I don't want it easy. And so I smoked that one joint on the 7th of February. I had no other plans. I didn't know where that was going to go. I didn't even really like pot, but it was there. It was there. And I smoked that one joint, and it did just for me what nobody and nothing been able to do before. It got me off the ground enough to where I was no longer in reality, but not enough to block it all out. And that for me became that moment, that flat line on the heart monitor on the inside of me. Physically, at 18 years of age, which I am at that time, I'm bouncing back real quick. I can look good on the outside, no problem. But there had been such a shell and an emptiness growing, emptying out time, day after day after day for so long that this was just the end. The bankruptcy and the quiet defeat is what happened within me that night. I hadn't planned it. It wasn't my idea. I didn't even ask for help. But what did come into my mind, instead of all the excuses and rationalizations and why my case is different, what came into my mind from some place, which I believe was God, those people in AA seemed to know what to do. And that next day is when I began my journey in earnest with you, on February the 8th, 1976. And I've never looked back. I went to the meeting I'd been going to once a week, and I went to the old timers there. To me, an old timer was anybody who'd been sober longer than I'd been alive. I went to them and I said, "What do you do to stay sober?" End of question, and the most important question I've ever asked in my life. Because there was no conditions on what you're going to tell me. There's no going to be yeah buts or maybe meh. Tried that, did it, blah, blah. No, I don't know what your answer is, but whatever it is fine with me. I want to do that because my life as I'm running it stinks. And I don't want to keep breathing if this is the way it's going to be. And so what they told me is one day at a time, we don't take the first drink or anything else that affects us from the neck up, and we have a sobriety date. We go to a lot of meetings and we get a home group. We take these steps and we develop a relationship with a God of our own understanding. We get someone that we can talk to, and that's a sponsor. Those traditions, Deb, those aren't just for the group, but also to learn to practice in your own personal affairs. We try to carry this message and to be of service. And that's the bar that they set for me, and that a high bar, but it's one that I try to shoot for every single day. And so one day at a time, I began this journey with you, and I jumped into Alcoholics Anonymous every bit of me. If I wasn't at work during the day, I was in meetings or service commitments at night. I was just full. I got a sponsor. I began to going from reading the big book, which I did not understand. She helped me learn to study the book, and it just started coming off the page. Because I had been an A student and an honor roll student at one time, and now I graduated from with a correspondence course just to get that diploma in hand. And I couldn't keep my focus on anything, and it was a couple of years before I began to be able to, it's seeping in and understanding and be able to remember maybe a little bit where some things were. And I was just a few weeks shy of my fourth birthday when I moved to Atlanta, and I was excited about that, and I got that sponsor, I got that home group locked in, I took a four-year cake, and there was this click in my mind, and it was almost like it said, you know, you're 4 years sober now, you know something. I have no idea where that came from. The problem was I listened to it, you know. Now, my sponsor, who's 27 years sober longer than me, I didn't bother running that know-it-all at 4 years sober by him, but I just kind of went on my business with that 4 years thing. And what I thought was, you know, 7 meetings a week is an awful lot of meetings now. Let's trim that down, get a little balance in your life, and we'll trim that down to about 2 or 3 meetings a week. Not that I had big plans like education or service work for the other nights of the week. No. It was just all self. And that 2 or 3 quickly became 2. And over the next 2 years, I went from being in that sunlight of the spirit to a dark alley on the inside. And I didn't know it. Because when it's so incremental, it, you know, when you're on the path and you just make a 1 degree, all of a sudden, it gets larger and larger. And that's what happened to me. It was like I started at 4 years with a square wooden box of one day at a time. I took sandpaper to it, and when you do it just one day at a time, and you just get those little crumbs things, and you wipe those away, and it still looks pretty square. But you get used to seeing it, and slowly, slowly, that square box becomes a round ball, and you wonder what's happening, and you're 6 years sober. I was, and I am so restless, irritable, discontent. I just can't stand it. I'm 24 years old, and I'm probably going to live a good long time, and I sure don't want to be in living like this. Now, I failed to look at the things I had shorted. I didn't look at that. I failed to look at the fact that instead of getting to my home group early, I'm getting there 5 minutes before the meeting, walking in my coffee and sit down, because that's all you have time for in 5 minutes, because you don't want to interrupt the start of the meeting. But you've done nothing of service or giving. And same with the end of the meeting. Instead of being one of the last people to leave the meeting, it's amen, shake, shake, and you're looking at taillights. I'm out of there. If you could have heard my mind after the second meeting in that week, you probably would have heard something like, well, got that done for the week. And you see, I was starting to visit my sobriety instead of participate in it. Punch in, punch out. And when I don't participate, it empties out pretty quickly. Well, I didn't look to just jump right back into service. I started looking out here for people, places, and things to make me happy. That will do it. Now, we got a little bit more specific on those words to be men, money, and mansions are going to make me happy. I'm living in Atlanta, and I'm looking for Rhett and Tara, you know? So, by golly, about 3 weeks later, I met a little fella, and it was on a Friday night, so that was kind of an omen to me. Lots of things happen to me on Fridays, and he met many of the qualifications I was looking for, and hey, he'd even been sober 13 years. Hadn't been to a meeting in three, but no problem. I'm going to help him. And I've learned perseverance in this program. By gosh, I'm going to put it to use. And selfishly, of course. And I flipped on the light switch of insanity on the inside of me is what happened. And this poor little fella, he didn't ask for my help. He didn't want my help. He wasn't interested in my help. But by God, I'm going to give it to him. And I'm going to get him swept up back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're just going to have this little AA cup of life. And after 3 months of this whirlwind romance, of which I was the only one involved. God, I hate those kind. This little guy went off and married somebody else. I let him go. I'm a good sport now. And you know, it's just as amazing that I just kind of took a glance around the room, and a few weeks later, up popped another little fellow, very similar in qualification. We did this dance of death for 3 months, and off he went to marry somebody else, too. And at 6.9 years of sobriety, I came crashing down one more time, just like I did on February 7th. It was a bigger boom, though, this time on the inside. Again, it wasn't about drinking, but it was about running my own life and how unsuccessful it really is. The only thing, and I know how slender of thread my sobriety, my physical sobriety hung, the only thing that saved my life from me picking up a drink is I never quit going to meetings. I knew from the very beginning they were clear. You make the first excuse not to go to a meeting. You'll have some guilt and debate and maybe some discomfort. But you won't when you make your second excuse. You've just greased it. And I was too afraid to get drunk again and that I would not be back. And so I kept going to meetings, but I wasn't really interested in anything but just sitting in that meeting and take, take, take. And I really didn't even want to take from you. I just knew it'd be safe, and I'd watch that watch of mine so I could get back out there and go find where he was at. And at 6.9 years, I came crashing down, and it was, Deb, you're an alcoholic. You have two options. You either drink for relief, which I knew was no longer really a viable option, or you recommit yourself to Alcoholics Anonymous 110%. Now, I know there is no such thing as 110% really, but what it means to me is I know intellectually and by my own history all the things there are to do one day at a time. It's the cushion of the and then some that has saved my life. It's the extra that I know to do. Not because a sponsor's watching, not because I want to impress somebody, it's because I want to stay comfortable today, and I do that extra each day. And so I began this journey again. I took the steps again as if I had never taken them before, with a fresh new vigor and with that current sponsor. And I made a last amend on my original list. And that, I knew I was clean. For the first time in 7 years, I was completely current and clean, and I knew it. And what happened is that about a year and a half later, I'm 8.5 years sober, active, working more, working with others, sharing, traveling, going on about, more in service, and I get a twinge of restless, irritable, and discontent. And one more time, I'm thinking, you know, why can't the total enthusiasm just be there all the time? And because I was sitting in a regular meeting of mine, the speaker that night talked to me. And what he said was, he'd had years of sobriety, he'd felt restless, irritable, and discontent, and he realized, you know what, I've been trying to live today on last year's program. And that was the only line I heard that guy say. That's exactly what I'd been doing. I'd been doing that, you know, aren't I just great kind of thing to myself for a year and a half. He completely rearranged how I look at this day. This is the day I stay sober, do my prayer. Nobody can do my sober actions for me. No matter how much they love me, or I love them, my sponsor can't, my husband can't, my friends can't. I am responsible for my sober actions, be they positive and be they negative. No one else is responsible for my welfare but me. And so it totally changed how I looked at one day at a time, and this is the day that counts. Let me make this day count. And a few years later, I would get married, move to Southern California, and after 5 years and 9 months of that marriage, it would come to an end. And it was during that time that nobody got custody of the home group, okay? You know, we all were in there. And I told you before what my little guideline was on checking myself, that I better be doing my job, because that's the only thing only purpose I have in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is to carry the message. Try to be the best example I can be. And my personal life gets left in the car. It doesn't mean that I don't have problems or that I'm phony and smile, oh, everything's fine. No, it doesn't mean that at all. It just means that I got a more important job than bending your ear on my problem. I have a sponsor for that and some close friends. I'm more interested about recovery and how I can share it with you. And so it was during that time, I was doing pretty good, and about Thanksgiving of that year, on Thanksgiving Day, it's a Thursday, as we all know, it's always on a Thursday, and it was just one of those days where I could see on the horizon that tsunami of self-pity on its way. I mean, that baby was coming in. And I'll tell you, I could see it, and you go from teary-eyed to crying to kind of blubbering, and then you're weakened and sliding down that wall, and you're sitting on the floor and hysterical. And I'd never felt a loneliness more before that day, from the day I was born to this moment. It just was going to be all that day coming in. And I said, you know what, you got about 30 minutes, you can just let her rip. But then you got to get up and get your shower and your hair fixed and your makeup on and dress, because you have a greeting commitment tonight. You see, they've never given me the out that you have to be spiritually fit to be a greeter. You do not have to be on the top of your game to be the literature girl. You do not have to be mentally suitable to be the coffee maker. You just show up, and all that stuff will find you and lift you back up. You see, I knew, and I'd seen from the examples of others, that when they have had the critical times, things like divorces or deaths in their lives, I've seen what happens when they withdraw. And I knew that the people and the things and the commitments I had in my life, because I kept thinking, shouldn't there be kind of a little, if you're doing everything right, shouldn't there be some sort of a little bit of an armor around you? Yes and no. Life will continue to happen, but the armor is the tools that I have learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Instead of reacting, how to respond. The women that I got to work with, the commitments I make for the tomorrows of my life have saved my life, and they can be as small or as large as the coffee maker or the greeter or whatever the job is. I show up not because I'm all four pieces put together, but because I'm physically there. The rest of that comes along. And these were going to be the props that helped me walk through a day at a time. And for a long, long time, I would get the most popular question asked to me, how do you stay in the rooms? How do you stay in the room when your ex so-and-so is there? And my answer is, you just do it one meeting at a time. You work the room and a few other things. And that's how I did that. And that darkness, that depth of hurt, became the great asset that I could share with you on what the program had shown me how to do differently instead of run away and hide out. So now I've got to look at my own inventory. This marriage is over. I look at my own inventory on, you know, my part. And I realize I know zero about being in a partnership. I don't know how to be in a marriage because I realized how selfish, self-centered, and self-serving I was in that one. And I had a lot of work to do. If I'm ever going to have something to bring to the table in a relationship, I got a lot of work to do. And I began to do that. And I began to do things much differently than I had been doing in the past. And in April of 2000, I'm at a convention in New Orleans, and I meet my husband, Kent. And a year later, we would get married. And what a fun journey we are on, and we are a couple of AA geeks, I'm telling you. It's just, you know, our second anniversary, we celebrated in Akron, and, you know, you can tell the program people from the non-program, because it's like, Akron? Do you have family there? I mean, sort of. But we're just a couple of AA geeks. Now, we are not attached at the hip, but we get to do so much together. And I really like the fact that he's sober less than I am. You know, he's the newcomer in the family. I like that part. And I only use that when I need to, okay? So we start this journey, and we're on our first anniversary. And we're back in Atlanta. And this is the last of the people, places, and things he needs to really see in my life. We're at my old home group on Friday night, having a great time. Go Skyline group. Saturday morning, wake up, do the same thing I do every day. Get on my knees, ask God, please help me stay sober today. And I just want you to know that that works really good. Because I'm 26 years sober, a few months. And we go to a luncheon that day that was scheduled. And this is with some non-alcoholic friends of mine. And we sit down at the table. And there's a pre-poured goblet of wine. Now, I've been around alcohol before. Usually I'm asked, and I obviously say no or turn my glass over if there's one on there. But this was pre-poured, and I sat down, and I just confirmed what it was. And he said, blah, blah, wine. And I said, oh. And I just pushed that thing forward of me. But what happened, and I don't know any clinical therapy click words that would go with it, but I do know what happened, is that that would activate for me 6-month physical craving to be drunk. Now, this is weird. Why is this happening? It was just kind of, you know how you get those drinking nightmares? And they are so real. And you wake up at 2 a.m. and your heart is just like this because you've already drank. You're wondering whether or not you should go back to way A in your dream, and you're just in a panic. Who do you tell? And you know, should I move towns? You know, I'll leave town. They won't know. And I mean, you just go through all of this stuff, and you come to, and you, okay, this ceiling is my bedroom. That's good. Okay. That is my husband. That's really good. Okay, so we're 2-0. We know where we are. We're with the right people. Okay. And then your heart starts to settle down. And I kept waiting for the wake up. I kept waiting for this weird feeling to go away. And it's not. For the next 6 months, it will circle round and round. It'll be heavy, light, but it won't ever go away. Now, I learned some things at this time, 26 years. I am right in the middle of you. I'm not somebody who goes to one meeting a year. I'm not somebody who just, I'll drop in, see how they're doing. I am in the middle of you. I am sponsoring the most women I'd ever sponsored at that time. I am active. I am current. I say my prayers every day. I feel a very strong connection with God. I don't understand why this is happening and why it's not going away. And my belief was that if I am doing everything right, there is no way that the thought or the craving could slip in. So then obviously there's a chink. And what is it? Okay, so I start running these micromanaged inventories of myself. I'm looking for anything out of place because I'm going to button that baby up right quick because I don't want to see have this feeling. Now, just to let you know, I am begging, pleading, asking, bowing, kneeling, requesting every way I can to God to relieve me of this obsession because I don't want it and I don't know why I have it. But I began to look at the things that I've seen take other people out. And I started to ask myself in those questions. Are you active with the sponsor? Absolutely. Are you working with others? Oh, yeah, most I've ever worked with on an active basis. Are you chipping away at anything? No. Are you flaking on meetings or commitments? No. Are you arriving early, staying late? Yes. Are you screening your calls? No. Are you doing near beer, near pot, near anything? No. Are you lying, stealing, cheating, doing even the least bit of inappropriate behavior? No. And I couldn't figure out. I'd ask my husband, you live with me, you see me every day. I'm not looking for rationalization. I'm looking for, do you see something that I'm doing that I can't see for myself? I'm talking to my sponsor. During this time, it just seemed like I'm getting a lot of wet drunks coming into my life. I have had more 12-step calls since I've moved to Northern California than I ever did in Southern California. I am actively involved with that, and I've got a lot of wet drunks coming into my life, and it was giving me this fresh appreciation for the powerlessness of this disease, that no matter how much they want to quit, to stop, to whatever, they can't. And so I'm getting this fresh view on it. And I just don't know what to do. I've picked up meetings, and I'm just really, really aware. I have not the mental obsession at all. It's the physical craving to be drunk. And there are actually times when I felt that I would have this brownout and I may drink against my own knowledge and will. It was that strong some days. And I just tell you, it was a terrible video that was going on in my head. And I could see that. And I didn't know what to do differently. And what happened is that one day I'm in a meeting. It's been going on about 6 months. I'm in a meeting that morning. Meeting's over. I'm on my way home. And I am struck with that feeling that I may drink against my will. And I don't know what to do. And so, of course, I don't know why. And I don't know how to get rid of it. But I call my sponsor. And she'd been going through some of her own things and health problems and hadn't been available. But boy, God knew I needed her more than anybody on the planet at that moment. And she listened to what I was saying, and I'm crying, and she's just simply said words I've heard before, but she said, honey, what we have is the disease of alcoholism, not alcoholism. And it made me okay. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not defective. I don't have a weak link with God. Let me tell you, if I had a weak link, you'd have a different speaker here tonight. It was so powerful. And I don't ever want it to happen to me again. I hope it doesn't. But I will never, ever forget how fresh everything was brought up. I never took my sobriety for granted. But the freshness of that daily reprieve based on the maintenance, and I maintain my spiritual condition daily. I did and I do. I didn't change any of the actions. But this made me feel like I'm not defective. I'm all right. I have a disease that will always be able to activate itself. And I turned, what am I doing wrong, to thank God I was doing everything I was doing, and I still got that feeling and that power. Thank God. What if I had been doing any of those things, chipping away at meetings or lying or flaking on commitment? What if I had? I hope I never know. You know, I think about doing stuff like this or anything I'm asked to do in AA, but especially when I'm asked to tell my story, whether it's on a 12-step call or at something like this. I think about those four things that Dr. Bob talked about in his story, and I'm not trying to compare me to Dr. Bob by any means, and this is paraphrasing, but he talks about he does it as a sense of duty. And I do have a responsibility that I take very seriously to be front and center in Alcoholics Anonymous and to give this thing away to whoever wants it, that it's a pleasure, and oh, pleasure times 10 to be here with y'all this week. This has just been amazing. That it passes on and pays back the man that took the time out to pass it on to him. And I'm so grateful for the people who didn't stay home the night that I came back to say, what do you do to stay sober? That they didn't take the night off. And that it will ensure him against a slip. And I'll tell you what, I am more than willing to do whatever it takes to avoid that slip, and I hope you do too. Thanks for having me.